Why, good evening. Could somebody bring a glass of water? I may need it because we're going to spend a lot of time singing tonight. It's been a blessing to be with you. I just really have enjoyed the singing, especially to see these young men heartily give themselves to song. The community has been a tremendous blessing. The hospitality, the fellowship, it's been really wonderful. Tonight, I want to talk, well, first of all, let's review a little bit. The first night we had Sing the New Song, in which I showed you from the Bible all the things that happen when we sing, supernatural things that we really need as resources in our lives. And the take home from that was that if you do not sing, there is a spiritual handicap. You do not have those resources at your disposal that God would have you have as a result of singing. And so that was the takeaway from the first night. The second night, we talked about what kind of music we should be singing. And we looked at what happens when music goes in the wrong direction and why it does. And what is a good song? What makes a good, a tune that will endure down through the generations? And then last night, we looked at Lead the New Song. And thank you so much. That's a nice piece of ice. Anyway, I tried to talk not just about song leading in church, but anybody who has any opportunity to lead a family in singing, a mother to teach her children, anybody who has the opportunity to lead out and initiate singing. And we talked about the qualities required for that, and we talked about various aspects of that, how important it is for mothers to be singing in the home, the ear training that children receive in a unique way from that. And so that was what we talked about last night. So I tried to give you some things, some practical things to get a hold of in understanding and practicing singing. Tonight we just simply want to look at the heritage of song. What is in this hymn book? Not just this hymn book, any hymn book. It's a collection of about 4,000 years of the very best literature that has ever been written. And it's a real treasure. A heritage is a property that descends to an heir. And we are the heirs to a priceless property that has been in the making for 4,000 years. I don't think we realize you were singing some wonderful texts tonight that had some real meat theologically and practically. It has gathered up the best expressions ever uttered on this earth. It truly is a collection of literature unrivaled by any other. And it would be an unspeakable tragedy if this inherited collection were to be lost. But that's exactly what is happening. This priceless 4,000-year-old treasure of wisdom and literature is being rudely pushed aside to make way for the exclusive use of songs written in the last 30 years. I was asked to lead a singing spontaneously at a banquet of liberal Mennonites here some years ago. I'd gone there to hear a person speaking on history, and they knew I liked singing, and so they asked me to just get up and spontaneously lead some songs, and I was amazed. Jesus, thy boundless love to me, they could not sing from memory. That was already on the way out. The enormity of what is happening can only be understood by an exposure to this heritage. Now, it's impossible to do a complete survey, and I don't want to do a lot of talking tonight, but we will look at a little bit of the history. We will look at a lot of hymn stories tonight, as much as we have time, till about 8:30 maybe. So, first of all, we're going to look at some Greek songs. The songs were originally written in Greek. Then finally, when the Romans took over, they were written in Latin. And that tradition lasted till about the 1200s. And sometime before that, singing basically disappeared in the congregation. And people were not singing anymore because the choirs had gotten so sophisticated and the plain song had become so hard to sing that it was done by special choirs. Liturgy took over. Services became very formal. So for about 300 years, the church didn't sing, except the groups that never became part of the Roman Catholic Church, those little minority groups, they probably went on singing. And then, finally, the Reformation came, and people started singing again. But they completely discarded the Greek and Latin hymns because they were Germans. They were French. They were Spanish. They could not sing those Latin hymns. And for some reason, they didn't have a great interest in them. And so those hymns basically were not used. They basically were basically in history. And then a very interesting movement took place in England. Spiritually, it wasn't a very good movement. Some highbrow English Church of England people said, this nation is going down, and the reason for it is because we have discarded the forms of the Roman Catholic Church, because the Church of England now had left the Roman Catholic Church, and you had the evangelicals, the Wesleys, and all these other people, and they said, we've got to go back to the Roman Catholic Church. And so part of that Oxford movement, and it began in 1833 by a man by the name of John Keble, who stood up and gave a speech on national apostasy. And he was proposing going back to the more formal Roman Catholic faith. And so after that, they took a great interest in not only going back to that, but going back and getting these Greek hymns. And that whole movement, of course, was not a good movement, I don't think. But the one good thing about it was they decided to go back and get these Greek hymns. And so you had men like John Neal, who began to translate these into English. And they are wonderful hymns. We're going to sing some of them. And what I want you to notice about them is the church up until the Wesleys, practically, did not sing much about personal experience. Even Isaac Watts, look at his hymns, and we're not going to sing them tonight, but look at them sometime. They're about the sovereignty of God. He never talks about his own experience except in When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, he says, we're the whole realm of nature and mind. He does talk a little bit personally there. But these hymns are impersonal hymns. They are pure worship. They focus purely on praise and worship. And I just want you to notice that. Let's turn to one, number five. Now, we're talking about the text. We're not talking about the music. We're talking about the text tonight. This hymn was written by one of the most colorful characters in church history, Ambrose of Milan. This man was educated for law and administrative duties, and he was extremely eloquent. He was so eloquent that Augustine moved to Milan just to sit under the eloquence of this man and managed to get converted. He went every day to hear this man preach and just to learn how to speak, and he got converted. So this man was extremely eloquent. He became the governor of northern Italy and lived at Milan. But it was a very difficult time in the history of that time. For 40 years, the Bishop of Milan had been an Arian. Now, Arianism said Jesus was not divine. He was the first and highest of God's creation, and they believe everything we believe about his crucifixion and resurrection, but they say he was not divine. Only God was divine. The Jehovah's Witnesses hold that view to this day. And so this man, this heretical bishop had been the Bishop of Milan, and he died. And the Orthodox people, who were Trinitarians, were hoping to elect a Trinitarian bishop. And so everybody rushed to the square, and there was a tremendous potential for a riot. And Ambrose went down to the square to make sure that there wasn't a riot. He talked to the people with his eloquence and calmed them down. And in the middle of that, some child said, Ambrose for bishop! Well, he was being instructed for baptism, but he wasn't even baptized. And so he ran away and hid. But the people were convinced that he would make a good bishop, and so they dragged him back, and they got him baptized, and he basically resigned his office, gave away his property, and gave himself to the church, and became a defender of the Orthodox faith. And in the process of doing that, he wrote a lot of hymns, because the Arians basically won a lot of their people by the hymns they were writing, and so he used the hymns, the Orthodox hymns, to win them back. And I want you to notice in this song, O splendor of God's glory bright, from light eternal bringing light. And it starts talking about light. It counters Arianism by affirming the deity of Jesus. Jesus is identified as the light as we sing through this song. We're not going to sing all the verses. in verse 3 especially, it talks about the effect that light has on us. And you can see how he follows that theme of light through this song. So let's sing verses 1, 2, 3, and 5. O splendor of God's glory bright. You'll recognize the tune. It's great God indulge our humble flame. And altos, please sing that ray at the end, okay? All right, my voice will not go high, so if there's high notes, I'll have to let you sing them. Do so, oh this is one of the oldest hymns in the hymnody that we have, written by Clement of Alexandria, who was the principal of the first Christian school to educate pagans coming into the church. The first believers in the church, of course, were Jews, and then the pagans started to come in. Well, they were immoral, they were violent, they were people who didn't understand anything about the God of the Bible, and so they felt they had to have a special school to educate them before they could baptize them. And this man was the principal of that school. Well, he finally wrote a book for instruction for these young people, and somebody took the book and distilled from it some of the basic concepts. This was not written as a hymn. This was taken from his book. The title of the book originally was Bridle of Colts Untamed. And I'll read you the first stanza of the original. We don't have all the verses. We don't have nearly all the verses. Here was the first verse. Bridle of colts untamed, wing of unwandering birds, sure helm of ships, shepherd of royal lambs, assemble thy simple children to praise holily, to him guilelessly with innocent mouths, Christ, the guide of children. This celebrates the blessings of being controlled by Christ. And you will notice all kinds of titles to Jesus in this hymn. I'll just call your attention to them. In the first stanza, he's a shepherd, he's a triumphant king. In the second stanza, he's the holy Lord, he's the all-subduing word, he's able to bring things under control. He's the healer of strife, that was an answer to their violence. The third verse, he's the great high priest. That's all we have there. Verse 4, he's our guide, he's our pride, he's our staff, our song, and our Christ of God. So you have all those And all of those are titles that address the needs of these violent, immoral, pagan people. Shepherd of Tender Youth. Let's sing verses 1, 3, and 5. Domine, Shepherd of Tender Youth, Christ our triumphant King, we come thy name to speak, tender our children, bring to shout thy praise. Thou art the great High Priest, thou hast prepared a feast of heavenly love. One in our mortal pain, the throne of peace in vain, thou fellest on the saint out from above. And mercy thou, our guide, our shepherd, and our pride, our staff and song. Jesus, the Christ of God, by thy word and your word, lead us where thou hast brought, make our faith strong. Oh, now. My hymnal has about a dozen of these early Greek and Latin songs. This one is by Synesius of Cyrene. Cyrene was a seat of a Greek colony in North Africa. It was a flourishing center of wealth and learning in AD 100. But by AD 410, the hordes of barbarians had begun to invade. And by this time, this Synesius was one of its last great citizens. He was a descendant of the Spartans, the Spartan Greek kings. He was a philosopher, he was a noble character, he was an orator, and he was the bishop of Cyrene. These are words of an old man who's run the whole gamut of his life. And he's seeing his whole civilization beginning to collapse. His beloved wife had died, all of his sons had died, and he is ready to face the future, and he didn't know what the future was going to be. It looked like it was going to be a violent, a little bit like our times. And so his only recourse was to throw himself wholly on the mercy and love of his Savior. And in this song, he expresses the best desires of every Christian: to experience forgiveness, the control of his passions, inner purity, loyalty, a quiet and sure guide for his life, and a future life of light and joy. This song, written 1,600 years ago, I think is very relevant to our day, considering what's happening to our civilization. Lord Jesus, think on me. Let's sing all of the verses to this. Do so, Lord Jesus, think on me. Amen. of Christ actually wrote these words. That's all of those we're going to sing, but I will give you a list of some others that are in the hymnal. Holy God, we praise thy name. That comes from this era. All glory, laud, and honor. Come, you faithful, raise the strain. Jesus Christ is risen today. Come, you faithful. I already have that. O come, Emmanuel. Jesus, the very thought of thee. O sacred head, now wounded. Jesus, thou joy of loving hearts. These are Greek and Latin hymns. Like I said, they're very objective. They say very little about our personal experience. They're just pure worship. Now we go, so the church then didn't sing for about three or four centuries. And then the Reformation brought the singing back. The songs we're going to sing next were written in this period. Are there any history students tonight that can tell me what that period was? Yes. That was the 30-year war when the Roman Catholics and the Protestants fought it out as to who was going to control Europe. And nobody won, by the way. But in that 30 years, they had devastated almost all of Western Europe. Horrible things happened during that time. The Catholic army would sweep across, destroy everything. People would try to rebuild. Then the Protestant army would come across. Some places, some towns and cities were destroyed four or five times till this was all finished. It was a horrible time. And at the end, of course, nobody won. So they sat down to draw up the Peace of Westphalia, in which they said the Catholics are going to have this country and the Protestants are going to have this country. And the Catholics, they decided which country they would each get. And the poor people who lived in the country, if they didn't want to be Catholics, they tended to leave or live under persecution. So it didn't get any better after the war as far as people who wanted to live a true Christian life in Europe. This song was written by, the song we're going to look at next is 690. This is a familiar song, and I think you'll sing it with more appreciation to know exactly I'm sorry. I have the wrong number here. Just a second. 572. The personal songs began finally to come into the church, especially out of this period. And I'll tell, you'll understand why after I tell you the story behind this hymn. This Paul Gerhardt was a student and a scholar who hoped to get married, but he wasn't able to get married during this awful time. He had hoped to be the pastor of a church. He was a Lutheran, and he wasn't able to pastor any church during this time. At 45 years of age, when this finally got resolved, like it did, he was finally able to marry the love of his youth, and he began to pastor a small church in his village. He became such an outstanding preacher that he finally was the pastor of the large church in Berlin, Lutheran Church. But then the controversy burst out between the Reformed and the Lutherans, and there was such bitter arguing and debates and hatred between these two groups that finally a rule was made there was to be no discussion by anybody on this subject. And he didn't feel that he could do that, and so he resigned his position. But till that time occurred, he was so sick and tired of theological debate, he decided that the issue was not theoretical theological issues. The issue was whether or not a person really did allow Jesus to come into his life and take over and give him a warm and devotional attitude toward Christ. And so it all became inward with this song and with all of his songs. Some people believe he was the precursor of pietism, which was very much involved in a warm devotion to Christ. But this was just a little bit before pietism. He was a Lutheran. But this is just a fabulous song. And the thing I wanted to point out is, even though this was a horrible time, some very wonderful things came out of this. You know, people during these kinds of experiences sometimes really have an intense appreciation for reality. And that's what you see in this song. He's basically just focusing on his love for Christ and what Jesus did for him. And he's trying to avoid all the controversy. So let's sing verses 1, 3, and 5. And on verse 3, I'd like for the tenors to take the lead. The soprano sing the high tenor. Bass is an alto, sing your regular part. So we're going to switch tenor and alto, tenor and soprano on verse 3. The soul, Jesus, I found that God to be, no God can be, so God be there, you my thanks, O Lord, to thee, and reign without the rival there. want you to go to the top of the page and look at the left. Who do we have to thank for the English translation? John Wesley. And that was an interesting experience too. John Wesley was sent to Georgia to be a chaplain for the prisoners that England was sending to Georgia to have a new start in life. It was a very rowdy community. John Wesley was a perfectionist. That's why he was called a Methodist. And he went there with his very strict ideas about how life should be and got in bad trouble with those people and fled Georgia right before he was arrested and thrown into prison. And so, again, a very difficult experience. He returned to England on a ship with a group of Moravians, and they were singing these German hymns. And he actually started the hymn tradition that Charles Wesley carried on by translating about a half a dozen of the best of those old German hymns that were being sung by the Moravians on his way back to England. Or maybe he heard them on the way over. I forget which trip it was. But so through two very difficult experiences, we have this wonderful hymn, which I consider one of the best hymns in our hymnal. Now I want you to turn to 237. John Herman was another person who lived through this horrible experience. His mother lost all of her four of her five children. He was the only one left. And she vowed that if God would spare her life, she would get him the education he needed to be a minister in the church if she had to beg on the streets. Well, during this horrible time, the village they live in was plundered four times. It was devastated by fire, then ravaged by pestilence. He lost all of his movable property several times. And he was in danger of sword and bullet several times. So it was an awful time. And finally, after the war was over, he became pastor of a church. But he had trouble with his eyes and his throat, and he finally was not able to pastor. So he retired from that and found his consolation in writing poetry. But the injustices that he had experienced during this had sensitized him to injustice. And so this story is about Jesus. Ah, holy Jesus, what did you do to deserve the treatment that you got? And then he says, I was part of that. I'm partly to blame for what happened. This is a tremendous hymn. We're going to sing all the verses because it has a real message. And the people who wrote the music really were able to match the sense of the music to the meaning of the text on this one. How many know this one? You people out here are singing all the songs in my book. I'm always excited when I come here. Do, so, do, la. Oh. 690. We're not going to sing this one, but I'm having you turn there because I'm going to talk about it. Very popular German hymn written by Martin Rinkert. You'll see his name on the left. And you see the date there, 1858, written 10 years after this. He was the pastor in a walled city, Eilenburg. And because it was a walled city, people fled there for protection during the things that were happening. And it became overcrowded, much overcrowded. So much so that in 1637, a great pestilence swept through the city and resulted in the death of 8,000 people, including his wife. He was the only minister in the city. The rest of them had fled to escape the plague. And so he alone conducted the funeral of 4,480 people. He was conducting 40 and 50 funerals per day. Can you imagine? It was overrun and besieged three times. Once by the Austrian army and twice by the Swedes. On one occasion, the Swedes demanded an impossible ransom or they were going to destroy everybody. And they could not pay the ransom. And so the only thing Martin Rinker knew to do was to ask the people. He said, look, if we can't get any mercy from man, we're going to have to get it from God. So he knelt down with these people and he prayed such a moving prayer that they reduced the requirement to a reasonable level. You would think that someone who had gone through that experience would write a very morbid hymn. The interesting thing about this hymn is all thanksgiving. There's not a word said about what he had gone through, except just almost an understatement in the first, the second stanza down in the third score. And keep us in his grace and guide us when perplexed. That's an understatement, considering what he had gone through. That's all. The rest of it is just an outpouring of thanksgiving to God. We're not going to take time to sing that. We have too many things to get through. So let's turn now, let's get some Mennonite history. Let's turn to 589. You will notice this hymn was written by Christian Burkholder. His father had visualized and helped to plan for a new community in the New World. They were coming from the Palatinate. But he died preparing for the migration and did not get to come. His brave widow came anyway, bringing her six children in 1755, right in the middle of the French and Indian War. 9-year-old Christian was the youngest. He grew up during that horrible French and Indian War in Pennsylvania. In 1770, he was ordained at the age in his early 20s to be a pastor in a Mennonite church, and in 1780, he was ordained bishop. This man traveled widely, establishing many Mennonite churches in Pennsylvania. In 1792, the first revival hit eastern Pennsylvania by the Methodists. Jacob Albright established the Evangelical Association, and the revivals began. And typical of most revival movements, they were exciting, they were demonstrative, people were shouting, raising their hands, hot preaching, all that that goes along with revivalistic experience. And typically Mennonite churches were much more tame than that. And so these revivalists were projecting what usually gets projected, that if you are a true Christian, you've had an emotionally defining experience. You've had some kind of real emotional experience, which Mennonites in that day didn't have that experience like it was described. And so these revivalists were able to convince most of the people that they had never been born again. And so they were leaving the Mennonite church in droves. And Christian Burkholder thought he needed to do something about that. So he wrote a tract. It still exists. I think Andrew has it on his table. I think you could get this if you wanted it. Addressed to youth regarding true repentance. And in this tract, and this was the second work of grace teaching too, that you could have a second experience where the old nature was eradicated and you could live a sinless life. And so he's addressing all of this in this booklet. And he says the proof that you're a Christian is not that you've had an emotionally defining experience. It's that something has happened to you, and inside of you, you're sensing pride turning to humility. And especially humility was projected as probably the most outstanding evidence that you're a true Christian. Incontinence is changing to purity. Hatred is changing to love. Covetousness is changing to liberality. Lying is changing to honesty. He said, if you sense those changes taking place in you, that's the evidence that you are a true Christian, and saved many people to the Mennonite church as a result of that teaching. So here's this hymn. It's expressing what it really means to be a Christian. Look at the second stanza. Giving him our heart's affection, true and upright we should be. This way leads us to perfection, not a second work of grace. Leads to God with certainty. And the whole song strongly emphasizes the Mennonite concept that to be a Christian is to live in obedience to Christ. It's a tremendous song, and we're going to sing all the verses. Christ is full of love and power. This is the only hymn he ever wrote, but it's a wonderful hymn, pretty much expressing our entire theology. Though so, Christ is now we're going to leave the historical songs, and we're just going to sing some songs with a wonderful story. You will notice on the left, the writer of this hymn is George Matheson. Does anybody here know anything about George Matheson? A couple of you. He was blind. As a child, he had weak eyesight, but he wanted to be a pastor. So he went to the University of Glasgow to study, and as he studied, his eyes got weaker and weaker, and it was pretty obvious he was going to become blind. But the tragedy of it was he was engaged to a young lady, and when she saw she was going to have a blind husband, she broke the engagement, and he never married. This song was written on the night of his sister's wedding, and he left us a description of how it was written. So I shall read exactly what he wrote. My hymn was composed in the manse of an Ellen on the evening of June the 6th, 1882. I was at that time alone. It was the day of my sister's marriage, and the rest of my family were staying overnight in Glasgow. Something had happened to me, which was known only to myself, and I just told you we know what it was, which caused me the most severe mental suffering. In other words, his sister's wedding just brought back all his frustration of his broken love. The hymn was the fruit of that suffering. It was the quickest bit of work I ever did in my life. I had the impression rather of having it dictated to me by some inward voice than of working it out myself. I'm quite sure that the whole work was completed in 5 minutes. Now this is the idea of him writing that a lot of people have. This is one of the few that this happened to. But yeah, he says he wrote this whole thing in 5 minutes. And he said, I'm equally sure that it never received at my hand any retouching or correction. In other words, he never edited it. This is exactly how it was at the end of 5 minutes. I have written, other verses I have written are manufactured articles. This came like a day spring from on high. I have never been able to gain once more the same fervor of verse. And it is a literary masterpiece. Let's take a look at it. Oh, love that will not let me go. That was the issue, love. I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean depths its flow may richer, fuller be. So picture a little mountain stream flowing down over a bunch of rocks with a bunch of mud and stones and noise and whatever, and it flows into the ocean and all that debris settles out and it becomes calm and deep and, yes, that's what he's saying. I'm going to give my troubled little life back, and in the ocean depths it will become something calm and beautiful. Then he picks up another metaphor. O light that followest all my way, I yield my flickering torch to thee. It might be a torch that was lighted from the sun with a magnifying glass. Who knows? But he's going to give that back to the sun. My heart restores its borrowed ray, that in thy sunshine's glow its day may brighter, fuller be. Then he picks up another metaphor. O joy that seeketh me through pain, I cannot close my heart to thee. I trace the rainbow through the rain and feel the promise is not vain, that morn shall tearless be. O cross, there's the crux. O cross that liftest up my head, I dare not ask to hide from thee. I lay in dust, life's glory dead, and from the ground there blossoms red, life that shall endless be. Red, a symbol of love, passion, sacrifice, blood, and beauty. That's what he finally experiences. Oh, love that will not let me go. We're going to sing the whole thing. Do so. Frederick Layman, in the 1860s was at an evangelistic meeting where he heard the pastor, the man who was preaching the sermon, close his sermon with the last verse of this song. The famous verse, "Could we think the ocean fill and were the sky a parchment made, were every stalk on earth a quill, and every man a scribe but trade, to write the love of God above would drain the ocean dry, nor could the scroll contain the whole, though stretched from sky to sky." And this intrigued him. So he wondered where that came from, and he found out that it came from the wall of an insane asylum where a Jew had been incarcerated, and in some lucid moment he had quoted this. And Frederick wondered if it was part of a larger work, so he did more research and found it was a part of a long poem written in the 11th century. So this song is more than 1,000 years old, that particular verse of it. And so he tells us that that poem was about God's persistent love for Israel and how he had delivered them and how he preserved them as a nation. And one of the incidents was a priest had accused a Jewish rabbi in the city of Worms, Germany, of some crime. And the governor of the city said, unless a rabbi appeared to give them a good defense, he would destroy all the Jews in the city. It was anti-Semitic back then, too. And a rabbi stepped up and made such a good defense that the Jews in that city were spared. And Frederick Lehmann thought this was such a notable piece of literature, this last verse, that he sat down and wrote the first two verses and the refrain, and also the music. So we have this man to thank for one of the most wonderful gospel songs we have, "The Love of God." Let's sing all three verses.
The love of God.
778. You will notice on the left-hand side, the name of the writer is William Voorhees. He was an evangelical who took a particular interest in the Sermon on the Mount and became non-resistant, in fact, in spite of the fact that he was never taught that in his church. He was so convinced that the Sermon on the Mount was the answer to life that he decided to go to Japan. And he was an architect, a very wonderful architect. In fact, he ended up doing a lot of work for the royal family in Japan and fell in love with one of the princesses. And she had determined never to get married because her father was a womanizer and had treated her mother terribly, and she hated men until she met this man. And she immediately sensed there was something different about him, fell in love with him, and he fell in love with her. But there was a problem. Japanese princesses do not marry Americans. And so that marriage was opposed. But interestingly, the prince mother also sensed that this was an unusual man, and she supported the marriage, and they got married. He became a Japanese citizen. He learned the Japanese language. Although he was an architect by trade, he held Bible studies in the evening, and he especially taught non-resistance to the Japanese people. He also instituted gospel principles in his business. The Japanese people had a habit of working their people to death 7 days a week. He worked them a regular 5-day week, gave them the weekend off, and paid them good wages. On one occasion, there was a building being built on one side of the street by Japanese builders, and on the other side of the street, a building was being built by his company. And they were similar buildings, and so everybody was sort of trying to decide who was going to win this contest to get the job done first. And everybody predicted the Japanese would get it done first because they worked 7 days a week, and his only worked 5 days a week. But his people came back on Monday morning rested and were able to work better than the other team, and they won. Well, during World War II, he was dismayed finally to see that his native country was at war with his adopted country. And, of course, because he was American, he and his wife went into hiding. They had to grub for food. Here, this princess, this is how she had to live. After the war was over, he was even more hated because of the way the war ended. But he was able to win these people back to his relationship with them. And by the end of the occupation, he was able to help write the peace between the Japan and the United States. This is an amazing man. If you want to read the story, it's a book called The Bridge of Love for Grace Nyes Fletcher. It's out of print. You would have to get it online. And I've told this story so many times, they're probably sold out by now. But anyway, The Bridge of Love, it's an amazing story. Well, this song was written before World War I, 1908, but it so beautifully expresses what this man believed. Domi, let there be
165. George Young was a pastor, a poor pastor of a little church, and he and his wife dreamed that someday they could build their own little cottage. So they scrimped and saved, and near the end of their life, they were able to do that. They built themselves their own little cottage. And they didn't live in it very long until he was called away to some meetings, and she went with him. And when they came back, there was nothing but a pile of ashes. Some person who hated him had burned down their house. This song is the result of that experience. Al Smith talks about visiting her in the poorhouse where she went after he died. He said he never met a happier person than Mrs. George Young. It's an amazing experience and an amazing response. So let's sing. Let's sing verses 1 and 3.
Dum dum in shame.
Charlotte Elliott was a portrait artist and a writer of humorous verse. She lived a high life. At the age of 30, she became a complete invalid and extremely bitter at God. One evening, Cesar Millan, the famous Swiss minister, visited the home. And something ticked her off, and she ended up railing on God and her family to the point where her family was completely humiliated and left the room. And she was there with Cesar Millan. And he said, "You're tired of yourself, aren't you? You're holding to your hate and anger because you have nothing else in the world to live for. And you've become sour and bitter and resentful." And Charlotte said, "Well, what's your cure?" He said, "It's the very faith that you would like to destroy." "Well, what do I need to do?" "Come to Christ." "How?" "Just as you are." This song is a result of her conversion. This song was written at a time when her brother was trying to build a children's home for orphans, I think, or a school to educate children of poor ministers. I forget. He had a building project, and they had all kinds of bazaars to raise money for this. This song was printed and sold, and the income from this song was more money than all the other money they were able to accumulate. And so she had a great part in building this wonderful home for needy children. "Just as I am, without one plea." We do not use this song the way it's usually used. We usually sing this song on our knees at communion, and often on Sunday morning. So, like some other songs, I would like to deliver it from the one use it usually has. And it's a wonderful song. Sing it sometime during a communion service. "Just as I am, without one plea."
Just as I am, without
as I am, thy love unknown hath broken every barrier down. And isn't that just what Jesus had to do to all of us? Now to be thine, yea, thine alone, O Lamb of God, I come, I come. Just that. During the second Welsh revival, many missionaries went out to various parts of the world, and one missionary family went to the Assam province in India, and they won one family to Christ. The village chief, the Hindu chief, was irate. He commanded the family to come to him, and he said to the father, he said, "Now, if you don't renounce this horrible religion that you've adopted, we're going to kill your two sons." And his answer was, "I've decided to follow Jesus, no turning back." So they killed the two boys. He said, "Now, are you ready to recant? If not, your wife is next." His answer was, "Though no one joins me, still I will follow. And finally, if you do not recant, it'll be your life." And he said, "The world cross before me, the world behind me, no turning back." And he was killed. Sundar Singh, who was a famous preacher in England, heard this story and set that incident, turned it into a hymn, and it was set to a folk song from India. So this is an entirely Indian song. "I have decided to follow Jesus."
"I have decided to follow
Just three more songs, if you'll bear with me. 585. You'll notice on the left-hand side at the top, the text was written by Christopher Ruby Blackhall. He was a Chicago pastor who made a trip to Kentucky to visit the Mammoth Cave. I've never been in that cave. How many of you have been in Mammoth Cave? Oh, okay. Well, they tell me it has 144 miles of unexplored passageways. And you have to look at the date here, 1871, no electricity. So that cave had no light. The only light it had was the lantern that was carried by the guide. And because of those many unexplored passageways, if you would have gotten out of the sight of that lantern, you'd have never gotten out of that cave alive. And so on his way back to Chicago, he reflected on this. And you see the analogy that he has. Follow the path of Jesus, walk where his footsteps lead. Don't you get out of sight. Keep in his beaming presence, there's that lantern. And how do you do that? By obeying everything that he says, every counsel heed. Cling to the hand of Jesus. If you really want to get out of the cave alive, or you really want to get through life safely, get a hold of Jesus' hand. So that's the second verse. That's all he wrote. And in our first hymnal that was widely used, that was used in our church, English hymnal, Hymns and Tunes, done by John Funk back in the late 1800s, those were the only two verses in that hymnal. And then when the church hymnal came out in 1927, I don't know if they know for sure who added the third verse, but I think they thought this. If we could add just one more verse to this song, it would pretty well give the entire theology of Anabaptism. So here it is. Take up the cross of Jesus. Sharing the shame he bore, self in the world denying, there's the separation. Love the Savior more. Tell all the world of Jesus, there's the evangelism. And tell of his great salvation and glory in his cross. So this song was not written by one of our people, but it expresses our theology so beautifully. Let's sing verses 1 and 3 to save a little bit of time. Don't follow
the path of Jesus.
Ray Palmer, who you see there on the left, was in his early 20s. He was trying to get an education, but he was trying to earn his way through school. So he was teaching at a girls' school. He was clerking in a store. He was studying almost full-time for the ministry, and he was working for his church. And he was terribly exhausted. So one night he sat down with his little Morocco-covered notebook and wrote this poem. In 1832, Lowell Mason met him on the streets of Boston and said, "Mr. Palmer, I'm putting together a new hymnal. Do you have a song that I can include?" And so Ray pulled out his little notebook and showed him this poem. And Lowell Mason said, "Mr. Palmer, you may live many years and do many things, but I suspect that you will be remembered most by this song." And I think it's the only thing he's remembered by, Ray Palmer. Notice, "May thy rich grace impart strength to my fainting heart." He was exhausted. "My zeal inspire." Let's sing verses 1 and 2.
"My faith looks up to thee.
Written by Charles Wesley, who wrote 6,500 songs. He tried to write songs on every phase of Christian experience. And he said his hymns were intended to arouse sinners, encourage saints, and to educate in the mysteries of the Christian faith. He tried to completely cover their theology as Methodists. This song is based on Matthew Henry's comment on Leviticus 8:35. It was Moses' charge to the priests. Here it was. Therefore, shall you abide at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation day and night 7 days and keep the charge of the Lord that you die not. Matthew Henry's commentary, you'll see reflections of it in this hymn. We shall, every one of us, have a charge to keep, an eternal God to glorify, an immortal soul to provide for, and one generation to serve. The song originally was entitled, Keep the Charge of the Lord That You Die Not. And that is a sober warning. Those who lead people astray, those who do not keep the charge and do damage to the kingdom of God, will be in bad trouble. In fact, do you know who the most dangerous person to society is, according to Ezekiel, I think it is, or is it Jeremiah? It's not the murderer. It's not the adulterer. It's the prophet that teaches lies. A murderer can kill a few people, and that's terrible. An adulterer can do a certain amount of damage, but limited. But a man who teaches lies can destroy a whole church, can destroy a whole nation. The most serious thing we can do is to betray our charge to be faithful to Christ. And the Wesleys were worked themselves to exhaustion and, like I said, managed to change enough lives in England of those rich industrialists who were taking advantage of their workers. They managed to change that enough that England was spared a bloody revolution. I want to read you about John Wesley's ministry and try to measure your devotion to the cause. John Wesley traveled 250,000 miles on horseback, averaging 20 miles a day for 40 years. It's averaged that he preached 40,000 sermons, produced 400 books, knew 10 languages. At 83, he was annoyed that he could not write more than 15 hours a day without hurting his eyes. And at 86, he was ashamed that he could not preach more than twice a day. And he complained in his diary that there was an increasing tendency to lie in bed till 5:30 in the morning. So you can decide how much you're getting accomplished. This is a wonderful song. A charge to keep I have, a God to glorify, a never dying soul to save and fitted for the sky. And then that awful, I shouldn't say awful, that very great challenge there at the end. Assured if I my trust betray, I shall forever die. I think of the many people who lead people astray into antinomianism and become undisciplined and take on the philosophy of the world. On the third verse, let's have the sopranos and tenors switch. And on the fourth verse, sing whatever part you want to sing. I hope we have six parts by the fourth verse. The soul. last word is be faithful. God bless you.